so that her heart stopped racing at every moment of the day. She still prayed for them. She still thought she might go back and get Patrick, bring him to New York. One December morning, as they walked to school, Kathy said, "Arthur says Roger just adores you. He's had a lot of fun these past few months. Could you see a future with him?"
"No,"
Teresa said. "Not with him or anyone." "Oh," Kathy looked surprised. Teresa herself was surprised. "Are you all right?" Kathy said. A question so simple, she couldn't help but answer,
"No."
Teresa started to cry. "Do you want to talk about it?" She shook her head. Kathy put an arm around her. She looked so concerned.
"I'm just in a funk lately," Teresa said, trying to make it seem like less than it was.
They were silent for a long while, and then Kathy said,
"Do you remember how I told you my mother and I go on retreat to a convent in Vermont every couple of years?"
"Sure."
"We were supposed to go for a weekend this winter, but with my sister having the new baby, my mother can't get away. I was looking forward to it, and we booked the room and all. It's just occurred to me, maybe the two of us should go. A change of scenery might do you good. It's a beautiful place."
"I'd love to, but I can't," Teresa said. "I'm busy then."
Kathy laughed. "I didn't say which weekend it was." Teresa swallowed. Her throat felt tight. A vision of herself screaming in Sister Bernadette's face, clinging to her child. A story she could never tell.
"I have a thing about nuns."
"These are easygoing nuns. Kind nuns, I swear. It's the quietest place I've ever been. When you get there, this sense of absolute tranquility comes over you."
"No, I can't."
"You'll love it," Kathy said. "I promise. It's not at all what you think." Teresa looked at her friend and smiled. Kathy had a way of making her do things she never thought she would.
"All right," she said at last. "Just for a night or two."
They drove up on a Saturday morning. Teresa was anxious, but she tried to focus on the surroundings and the conversation. Vermont was beautiful. Curtains of tall trees in every direction. They turned off the highway and drove through a quaint town square, then followed a winding road through the countryside, past farms and fields, until Kathy said, "Here it is." The first thing Teresa noticed was the emblem of the miraculous medal emblazoned on the gates.
"What is that doing there?" she asked.
"It's their symbol, I guess you could say. You see it all around here." Inside the gates, Kathy stopped the car in front of a massive stone building. "It's converted from an old brass factory," she said. "Isn't it amazing?" Attached to the building at either end were high wooden fences, 10 or 12 feet tall. They made Teresa wonder what was on the other side. An entryway with walls made of stained glass jutted out at the front of the building. They went in. The room was a conservatory. There was a small fountain flanked by birds of paradise, peonies, alliums, cactus plants in all shapes and sizes. At the back wall, a short flight of stairs led to an open door, a small dark vestibule. Inside the space was another door, the top half of which was a wooden grate. A nun stood behind it. She looked trapped in there, a prisoner, but she smiled warmly. It was impossible to say how old she was. She greeted them in Latin. Teresa didn't know how to reply, But Kathy said something brief and formal, also in Latin. And then the formality was over. The nun squeezed Kathy's hand through the grate.
"We're so happy you're back.
Sister Ava, this is my friend Teresa Flynn. Teresa moved to New York from Ireland."
"Ah," the nun said. "With your family? Your husband?"
"Just me," Teresa said.
"How brave," the nun said.
No one had ever said that to her. Teresa and Nora came alone, just as millions of other girls had before. No one she knew seemed to think of it as brave. It was simply what one did.
Sister Ava told them lunch would be served in the women's refectory in an hour. Afterward, if they liked, the nuns would put them to work.
"We'd love to, sister," Kathy said. "Thank you."
When they were back outside, she said, "When you work with them, you get to go into the enclosure.
The other side of the high fence."
St. Gregory's guest house was a creaky old cottage with wide wood plank floors. The house was empty when they arrived. Teresa stepped from the front hall into a cozy living room with two floral couches and two armchairs, one blue and one white. The room was lit by lamps. Books were everywhere. On the coffee table, the dining table, the end tables, on the built-in bookshelves that flanked the stone fireplace. A mix of religious and not, left by guests, she supposed. Green potted plants sat on the shelves and climbed the lace-curtained windows. Dark wood beams lined the white ceiling. Paintings of the Madonna and Child hung on every wall. The pink afternoon light, as it shone into this room, gave Teresa a sense of peace she hadn't felt in ages. Kathy showed her the dining room with its plain wooden table and chairs. No two chairs were the same. In the kitchen, the plates, too, were all decorated in different patterns, most of them chipped here or there. The refrigerator was full of homemade jam and bread and raw milk from the dairy. Every bedroom was named for a saint. A chalkboard listed their room assignments. They'd be sharing St. Lawrence on the second floor. A woman named Maura would be in St. Agatha on the first. There were four more rooms besides. In their bedroom, the mattresses were so old and soft and thin, you could feel every spring. Threadbare towels and sheets sat folded at the foot of each bed. Lunch was fried fish and French fries with tartar sauce, mushy peas, raw milk, tea and cake. It was served in the same stone building Teresa saw when they arrived, which she now knew was the enclosure where the nuns lived. She and Kathy entered from the public side, a door that led to a tiny dining room, but with nothing to connect it to the rest of the building except a window with a wooden grill crisscrossing it. The nuns who had prepared the food handed it through the grill. The brief glimpses of them standing there in full habit with a steaming bowl or glass jug of milk in their hands did something to Teresa. She felt desperate to pass through that wall and sit down to eat with them in their private quarters, though she couldn't say why. Maybe it was just the old curiosity that Nora was always trying to tamp down in her, the sense of not knowing, and as a result, wanting more than anything to know. The nuns were friendly. They smiled. They seemed tranquil, satisfied, in no rush. But they said almost nothing, leaving her to wonder how they ever came to live in a place like this. Her job that afternoon was to work with Mother Lucy Joseph in one of the gardens. The nun was probably in her late 70s. She said she'd had a recent injury and couldn't do much. "You'll be doing most of the work, I'm afraid."
She instructed Teresa where to cut back the plants, big and small. Some were just weeds, but others were actual tree branches. Teresa got the enormous shears around a particularly thick branch and pulled the handles together as hard as she could. The sharp blades nicked the branch, exposing the green flesh beneath. But she couldn't get the blades any tighter than that. "Let me try," Mother Lucy Joseph said kindly. She took the shears, and with a quick snap, the branch fell to the ground.
"Well then," Teresa said.
The nun winked. "I've had a lot of practice."
"May I ask you a question, Mother?"
"Of course."
"How old were you when you came here?"
The nun stood up straight. "Much younger than I am now. Older than you, though. I was an opera singer in a past life." Teresa thought she was joking, but the woman went on. "I sang at Carnegie Hall. I had the biggest record contract of any American opera singer in history up until then. But at a point, it all began to feel flimsy. So now I sing the Divine Office louder than most would probably like me to. And that suits me fine."
An orange cat sat watching them.
"That's Chester," the nun said. Teresa saw another nun, a young one, toss a tennis ball to a collie as she hauled out the trash. She had the feeling that the immediate, the task at hand, was everything here. She thought about the women in the teacher's lounge at school, who seemed to be waiting for something better, some man who might set life in motion. At 5:30, the nuns sang vespers in the chapel, separated from the pews by a black metal gate. In the half hour between vespers and dinner, Teresa and Kathy escaped to the Gulf station in town, a 10-minute drive away. It was the closest marker of civilization, the only one near enough for them to get there and back in time. All the shops were closed, but the Gulf sign glowed. "My mother and I made this our tradition. We always came to the station and got a bottle of Coke from the machine. Good to know that there is still a world out here and that we will soon be back in it," Kathy said. Teresa agreed, even though she had felt elated during vespers, a sense of lightness coursing through her. They got back 2 minutes before the start of dinner. The only other person at the refectory table was Mara, whose name they had seen on the blackboard. She was a nervous-seeming woman, the mother of a young postulant. She had a short silver bob, poofed up and flipped at the ends. She wore a black dress, belted at the waist. Teresa wanted to ask her so many questions, but she held back. The nuns sang complain at 7:30, after which all work was complete. The women were expected to be in the guest house for the night. Teresa and Kathy got into their beds with cups of peppermint tea and talked about the day, about the nuns themselves. Teresa was reminded of something. Remembering it for the first time in so long, she laughed. "I wanted to be a nun when I was small," she said. "So did I," Kathy said with a smile. "I think all Catholic girls go through that phase, don't they?" The bed was uncomfortable, springy. Teresa was sure she wouldn't sleep. But as soon as her head touched the pillow, out she went. She couldn't remember ever sleeping so well. Not since leaving home. Not since leaving Patrick. The next morning, the bells woke her at 6 o'clock.
"They have to pray again already?" she whispered.
"Yes, they prayed at 2 a.m. too. You must have slept through the bells."
"Could we have gone?"
"No, That one is done in the enclosure. Once again, the forbidden nature of the thing intrigued her. She felt as if she would do anything just to be there, to hear the voices rising into one in the darkened chapel. The nuns couldn't technically talk to them outside of private parlors or while they were working together, but they found their ways. After 8 o'clock Mass, a nun approached and handed them each a slip of paper. Teresa said that Mother Monica would pick her up at 10 to go clean out a house on the far edge of the property. At 5 after, the nun pulled up in an old Ford station wagon.
"Who are you?"
she asked with a frown through the open window.
"I'm Teresa Flynn, Mother."
"Where's Mara?" she asked.
"I'm not sure."
The door to the house opened behind her, and out she came.
"Mara!"
the nun exclaimed joyfully, as if they were the best of friends.
"Such a delight to meet you."
She reached across and opened the passenger door from inside. Mara got in front, so Teresa sat in back. On the drive, Mother Monica explained that a nun had made her final vows a few days ago. Her family had stayed in St. Gertrude's guest house, and it was now their job to tidy up after them. They passed fields of grass, dried to a wheat-tinged gold. There were massive pine trees clustered around them, and maples that she thought must be glorious in autumn. Teresa felt sad that she wouldn't be here to see them. 2 old boxcars stood in a field. The nun said one was used as a pottery studio, the other for stained glass. A shed behind them was the blacksmith's workshop. She explained that whatever the abbey had was donated. Hence the denim habits that they wore to work outdoors. Someone had provided reams and reams of the stuff, and the nuns had found a clever use for it, as they did for all things. St. Gertrude's was a white farmhouse with a wide front porch. They entered through the kitchen. Mother Monica pulled sheets and towels from the clothes dryer, placing them in a wicker basket.
"Teresa, was it?"
she said.
"Yes, Mother."
"Why don't you go upstairs and vacuum the bedrooms and clean the bathroom? Mara, you stay here with me and fold all this laundry."
There wasn't much laundry to fold, certainly not enough for both of them. Silently, Teresa questioned the logic of giving up her weekend to come clean a bathroom that had been dirtied by strangers. But she wasn't about to argue with the nun. She walked upstairs, found the vacuum in a narrow broom closet in the hall. The guest houses were lovely, but when she looked closely, she saw the humble nature of it all. In the bedrooms, ceilings were lined with cracks. Below drafty windowsills, paint peeled off the wall and fell in flakes to the floor. Electrical outlets were dead or hanging loose. Nothing matched. Every so often, Teresa would go to the top of the stairs and listen. "Sister Jane is a beautiful fit here," she heard the nun say. "The Mother Abbess says she's never seen a girl take so naturally to the abbey." Teresa understood that Sister Jane was Mara's daughter. In the afternoon, Teresa and Kathy worked with Sister Antonia on a patch of grass outside the monastic art shop. A young Japanese maple stood there. Sister Antonia explained that the tree was diseased and the salt brought in each winter on the snowplows was making it worse. They were to build a fence out of wooden stakes she had sharpened earlier that week, joined together by a long sheet of thin metal and a roll of burlap. The aluminum she had had for years, the burlap, she didn't know what she'd do with until the idea came to her that morning. Nothing wasted.
"Didn't cost a penny,"
the nun said. Teresa wondered how old she was.
how long she had been here. She mentioned in passing that she had studied philosophy for 12 years. She had wrinkles all over her face. Her designation, sister, meant she had not yet taken final vows. They worked for hours in the cold, using heavy mallets to drive the stakes into the ground. Teresa could see her breath. She was reminded of the farm back home in a way, yet this was entirely different. Not a man in sight. When they were half finished, Sister Antonia went into the enclosure kitchen to make them a pot of tea so they could warm up. She returned with a metal teapot and 3 paper cups. She filled the cups to the top, handed one to each of them. Kathy and Teresa began to drink. The door to the art shop opened, and out came the big-haired blonde who volunteered at the register. Teresa had overheard her earlier, gossiping away with a customer. Sister Antonia raised the remaining cup of tea, the one that she had intended for herself, and said, "Judy, tea?"
"Sister, thank you,"
the woman said. "It is chilly out here, isn't it?" She had only been outside for 30 seconds, Teresa thought. She was about to climb right into a warm car and no doubt drive home to a big warm house. "We're so grateful to you for the $500, Sister Antonia said. "We've designated it for the chapel roof. It will be a godsend."
"Good, good," Judy said. "And what have we here?"
"A fence that we pray will stay standing for at least a few more weeks," Sister Antonia said. "It's ugly, but it'll be enough to protect the tree."
"What you need there is a low stone wall," Judy said.
The nun laughed as if it were a fantasy beyond all reckoning, which Teresa assumed it probably was.
"I'll talk to my husband," Judy said. "I'm sure we can cover it."
After she drove off, Sister Antonia said, "We are so fortunate to have her. She's marvelous." Did she actually think so? Walking the property that morning, Teresa had noticed bands of loud-mouthed women who came to see the crèche and go to Vespers and the shop. Her own uncharitable reaction to them made her think that she could never be a nun. Some of the nuns seemed to be without motive. Others had a clear agenda, a more business-like approach. Mother Lucy Joseph was articulate and kind and warm. Mother Helena was stern, but with a soft heart. This one, Sister Antonia, was a salesman. They needed all of these things in balance. They needed to sell themselves. They thanked their benefactors during prayers of the faithful. They required money and recruits, and yet they couldn't be so bold as to actually ask for either one. Teresa thought of the greeting the portress had given her, inquiring whether she had come to America with a husband. As they were packing the tools into Sister Antonia's pickup truck, she said to Kathy, "We're all so happy to see you here again. The Mother Abbess hopes you might join us one day. She thinks you have a calling."
"Not me, Mother. I'll be engaged soon," Kathy said.
Teresa wasn't sure why this surprised her, and she couldn't say why it hurt her feelings to be excluded from the Abbess's remarks, even as she felt relieved that the comment hadn't been directed at her. She reminded herself that she had not yet met the Abbess. Late that night, from the bathroom at the top of the guest house, Teresa found that she could look across the road right into the nuns' dormitory. She felt a sense of longing mixed with revulsion. She was so grateful that she still had the option to leave when she liked. Before they went home the next morning, Kathy said they should each have a parlor. Teresa's was with Mother Lucy Joseph, the nun she had worked with in the garden. They sat in separate rooms, connected through a grate like the one in the dining room. Teresa tried to see all that was on the other side. She could make out a wooden cross on the wall, a stack of books on a shelf in the corner.
"You've been a very good helper," Mother Lucy Joseph said. "How did you find your time here?"
"Oh, I enjoyed it very much. I don't want to go back to New York."
Teresa laughed as she said it, meaning for her words to sound light, but Mother Lucy Joseph didn't reply. She let the comment sit there between them.
"I've never had a parlor before," Teresa said. "I'm not sure what I'm supposed to talk about."
"God?"
Mother Lucy Joseph laughed.
"You can talk about whatever you like. Tell me what's in your heart."
Teresa found herself saying that teaching was often exhausting, that she wondered if the job, which she had always felt drawn to, really mattered at all.
"My students don't seem to get much from the lessons," she said, "but maybe that's my fault."
"Why would it be your fault?"
"Maybe I'm too distracted."
"By what?"
She had a choice: to keep the conversation at the surface or go deeper. She had never confided in a nun before.
But Mother Lucy Joseph struck her as wise, unflappable.
"There are things I regret deeply, Mother," she said. "I've hurt people I love. But I try to get on with it. I try to keep my feelings at bay."
"Why?" Mother Lucy Joseph said.
"What do you mean?"
"I mean, let yourself feel something. Don't be afraid."
In the car on the way home, Teresa told Kathy everything. About Walter and the dances and the nuns at St. Mary's, about Nora and Charlie, about Patrick. Teresa felt afterward as if someone had filled her body with air where it had once been made of lead. She felt as if she might float out the window and up, up, up into the sky. Teresa and Kathy returned to the Abbey for a weekend every other month or so, keeping to their routine. They always slept in St. Lawrence, always took their nightly drive to the gas station to get a bottle of Coca-Cola to remind themselves that they were free. It was on Teresa's fifth visit that she finally asked Mother Lucy Joseph what she had been wondering. The nuns created such peace for their guests, but did they feel it themselves? Was such a thing even possible? They were washing gardening tools in a metal basin filled with warm, soapy water, wiping rakes and hoes and shovels down with motor oil. In the barn behind them, a John Deere tractor sat surrounded by wheelbarrows, tarps, milk crates. "The orientation of all we do is to remember that it's in the direction of something bigger," the nun said. "On the outside, you feel taken up by this peaceful energy. Once inside, you realize you have to create it. If you're frustrated, you can't just go off." "I'm interested to know, my dear, why do you ask?" Teresa said she was only curious. The nuns invited Teresa and Kathy to come and stay for the month of July, when school would be over for the year.
Chapter 12. Kathy and Arthur were engaged in early June. He gave her a ring with a tiny diamond in it, and she wore it everywhere, tilting her hand this way and that, admiring how the stone sparkled in the sun.
Teresa worried that Kathy wouldn't want to go to the Abbey now. But on the 1st of July, off they went. As soon as they reached the gates, Kathy took her ring off and placed it in the glove box. "For safekeeping," she said. Sister Ava greeted them in Latin and then immediately squealed, "Congratulations! Have you chosen your wedding dress yet?" 2 weeks passed in blissful occupation, the two of them caught up in the nuns' daily rituals. Then, as planned, Roger and Arthur came for a visit. For the first time since leaving New York, the girls curled their hair and powdered their faces. Kathy put her ring back on. The nuns gave them the weekend off. The four of them spent the days swimming in the nearby lake, browsing in antique shops they could never afford. Teresa enjoyed herself, but she didn't feel well. Her head ached. Her stomach was a jumble. On Sunday night, the couples split off. She and Roger had dinner and drove until they found a quiet road beside a stream. The evening light was fading to darkness as they walked hand in hand. He kissed her, ran his palm along her back, and lower to her bottom, leaving it there, a question mark. She had the strongest urge to ask him to make love to her, though she didn't say so. She couldn't explain why to herself, but she kept thinking it would be her last chance. She cried as they said goodbye at the gates. He wiped a tear from her cheek and kissed her, saying, "Silly girl, we'll see each other soon." She looked past him to the image of the miraculous medal forged in iron. It was then that she understood. She had assumed the Virgin Mother was guiding her to Patrick. But now she saw that the medal had been drawing her here. Teresa was quieter than usual over the next few days. She worried that Kathy might find her behavior strange, but her friend was distant, too. She didn't seem to notice. One night, Teresa couldn't sleep. At 3 a.m, she got out of bed and went to the bathroom window, looking over at the building where the nuns lay sleeping. A single light was on the 3rd floor. She saw a flash of black pass through it. Here in this place, through these women, Teresa had felt the pure presence of God in a way she hadn't since she was a child. She wondered if her devotion was real, something she could sustain for the rest of her life, or if one day the spell would be broken and she would see that she had only been seeking an escape. Deliberating from here, from the outside, seemed pointless now. She knew that there was only one way to know. She felt elated. She couldn't sleep for thinking of how excited she was to tell them what she had decided. A few hours later, she and Kathy dashed through fat raindrops to get to breakfast, the collars of their jackets pulled up over their heads to protect their hair. Teresa said, "I want to join. I want to stay for good." She held her breath, waiting for Kathy's reply. She thought her friend might try to talk her out of it. She almost hoped she would. But Kathy stopped, stood still, as if she no longer noticed the weather. She took both of Teresa's hands in her own. "So do I," she said. "I've been thinking about nothing else since the start of summer. Longer, maybe. Oh, Teresa, how will I ever explain it to him?" Finally, then, Teresa wrote to her grandmother. She begged forgiveness for not writing sooner. She told her she had been teaching in New York, visiting the nuns with some frequency, and that she was living with them now. Her grandmother wrote back, "Your father and I don't understand.
What on earth are you doing there?
As postulants, they wore a plain black dress, a white veil. They learned to speak Latin and chant the Psalms. They were to read the Rule of Saint Benedict every day until they had committed all 100 pages to memory. This part Teresa enjoyed. It felt like going back to school. They were to relinquish all worldly possessions. This, too, was easy enough for her. She had already left everything she knew behind, not once, but twice. She thought of Kathy's home, her books and her small black-and-white television, her darling cat who had gone to live with her parents, the man she had planned to marry. If Kathy could do it, then so could she. They learned quickly how vast the distance was between being a visitor to the convent and becoming nuns themselves. There was no longer any escape, no more drives to the gas station to catch their breath. Their lives were constructed entirely of rules. There had been times in her life when Teresa felt as if she was under someone else's control, Nora's mostly, but she had a knack for finding ways around that. Now, the entire goal was for her own desires to be expunged, her free will relinquished. Postulants were not to share their worries with one another, to chat, to idle. Speaking to outsiders without permission was forbidden, as was unnecessary laughter. Was laughter ever strictly necessary? She wondered. Her letters had to be given to a superior, unsealed, before they could be mailed. Ora et labora, prayer and work. That was all that her life would be here. Teresa discovered that the nuns walked slowly, hands tucked, eyes lowered, not because they chose to, but because it was mandated. They weren't to rush or to run. This made her want to dash around the property with arms outstretched. Every infraction was punished severely. If you were a second late, you were made to kneel and kiss the floor. She thought of the factory back in Ireland, where her pay was docked if she came in more than 3 minutes past the hour. She had found the policy overly strict at the time. Now, Teresa saw that those 3 minutes were a gift. They accounted for being human. She no longer even had Kathy anymore. Not in the way she once did. They could exchange only the rare whispered conversation in passing. When Kathy came down with the flu and had to stay in bed for a week, Teresa thought to bring her a hot lemonade. A few hours later, she was called to the abbess's office. "Is it true that you entered another nun's cell?"
"Excuse me, Mother?"
"One of your fellow postulants saw you and reported you. You know particular friendships are forbidden."
"Particular friendships, Mother?"
"You will have to be punished."
She was embarrassed by how quickly the tears came when she was rebuked for some mistake or another, which she was, nearly every day. The only person who had ever spoken harshly to her before was Nora. And then there was love in it, an almost amused resignation. Not so here. Inside the dormitory, the small bedrooms were drafty and bare. The building was silent but for the occasional muffled cry of a girl in the night. The sound made her think of St. Mary's, of the time when Patrick was only hers, though she hadn't wanted him then. She chastised herself for this now. It seemed a person never had the information she needed at the moment it would help her most. She prayed for him first thing each morning, and last thing every night before bed, Somehow, being here, the intensity of the quiet, put him at the forefront of her thoughts as he hadn't been since the night she left him. Kathy told Teresa in a stolen moment that her family was devastated. They longed to have her back. They were allowed to visit twice. Her father cried at both parlors. Arthur wrote and wrote. Her mother reported that he came to them and said the nuns had brainwashed her and they ought to call in the police, the president, the FBI. Kathy was surprised by how hurt her parents were. She had three aunts and one great aunt, all of them nuns. But that was different. None of them were cloistered. Teresa's own father wrote to say she was making the wrong decision. It hurt her deeply until she realized that he knew the cloister meant she would never return home. After a year, Teresa and Kathy both joined the novitiate. They were given their habits and their names in a joint ceremony on a sunny afternoon. The mother abbess cut off their hair, placing the long strands in a golden bowl. A party in the Jubilee barn followed. The one festive day of the year, cake and ice cream and wildflowers on all the tables. Kathy was to be called Sister Placid, and Teresa, Sister Cecilia. The elders warned them that a year was nothing, that one or both of them would most likely leave in time. The canonical year came next, a period of no contact with the outside world. When it ended, Arthur was truly gone. He had married someone else. When Sister Placid's parents came for the first time after such a long absence, she said her mother acted as if nothing had changed. She insisted on calling her Kathy and wanted to catch her daughter up on all the news. Her sister was pregnant again, 7 months along. Mrs. Kennedy had given a tour of the White House, and the whole thing was shown on television, and her taste was impeccable. Outside, it was 1962. But here, nothing was any different than it was a year or a decade before. Sister Placid said her father was no longer crying. Now, perhaps, he was angry. All he could talk about was the paint everywhere, how it's peeling, how it doesn't look good, she said. A week later, walking to the chapel, Sister Placid saw her father on a ladder painting the barn. The abbess said, "He volunteered to do the whole place for free. Anything to be near you, I suppose." Her own family was so far away that it was impossible to say whether they approved of what she'd done. But her father's and Gran's letters were kind from then on, accepting her decision. She didn't write to Nora. Every letter her grandmother sent mentioned this fact. Her gran insisted that they must talk to each other, and Sister Cecilia realized that Nora hadn't told the family the truth. Gran thought they had merely had a disagreement. 2 years at the Abbey behind her, and still she often cried for half the day. Mother Lucy Joseph told her this was as it should be, that any girl sailing through with a smile was lying to herself, to them all. The outward tranquility did not reflect their inner turmoil. She thought that if they could somehow hear what was inside them all at once, the sound would be thunderous. Her own doubts were a constant stream of voices in her head, all of which boiled down to a single question. Was she in hiding? Or was she home? Sometimes she thought she must be insane to stay here, when she could be in New York City, looking at a dress in a shop window, riding the subway to the Metropolitan Museum of Art. She thought every night of simply walking out, down the hall of the dormitory, down the three flights of stairs that led to the front door. They weren't locked in. She could do as she pleased. Could slip out and hitch a ride to the one bar in town and get drunk and kiss a stranger and be back in bed by dawn. She could even go to the bus station and catch the Greyhound to Boston, where she might pretend the whole thing had been just a whim. But she never left. Never even slipped through the Abbey gates and walked alone down the darkened road at midnight, as a few of the other novices admitted to doing. She stayed enclosed, even when it felt like drowning in molasses, even when she could not breathe. Beneath the raging doubts was a low, steady voice that said to keep on. She made long lists of things she could not live without: lipstick, gossip, the smell of the ocean. But then she found that she could live without them after all. One of Sister Cecilia's many jobs was to answer letters requesting prayers, and those that had been sent in gratitude for prayers the nuns had already said. This task let her know that it mattered, that they were doing something good here, even when it couldn't be seen. She hearkened back to her childhood saints for courage. She had once found such romance in their struggles. She recited from The Rule, the same line again and again. Do not be daunted immediately by fear and run away from the road that leads to salvation. It is bound to be narrow at the outset. The weather that third winter was bitter, bleak. A week before Christmas, a package arrived. It was addressed to Teresa Flynn, the name scratched out and Sister Cecilia Flynn written in below. She tore back the brown paper and saw the wool in a pale shade of violet. Her grandmother had sent a gorgeous sweater she'd spent the whole fall knitting. The postage alone would have cost more than she could afford. She lifted the sweater to her face and swore she could smell the kitchen fire back home. It brought to mind a vision of her gran sitting at the table in the firelight, stitching away, humming under her breath. She felt the strongest desire to return to her. That night, she slept with the sweater pressed against her cheek. The next morning, the novice mistress took the sweater away. It will go to a more senior nun, she said. Saint Benedict regarded private ownership as a vice. He instructed his followers to depend on the monastery for everything. It's too soon for you to have such a gift. When spring came, the abbey was suddenly beautiful. Every tree and flower in bloom. The change in the air made her think of what springtime had meant to her all her life, until now. The possibility of new love. The smell of a handsome stranger's skin at a dance. Pretty dresses, flirtatious smiles in the street. None of it to be hers ever again. Things she might never have noticed before could bring her to joyful tears. A red-throated robin in a tree. A row of purple rhododendron bushes 10 feet tall. But with this joy came fresh doubts. Sometimes she worried that her love for God wasn't as strong as her love of this place, and that eventually that unfortunate truth would force her to go. She confessed her feelings to Mother Lucy Joseph when they were working in the garden one morning.
I don't think of God every second of every day, she said.
And what do you think God is? Mother Lucy Joseph replied. You're not spending your days thinking of a man in flowing white robes, is that it? Well, that's not God anyhow. She was surprised when Mother Lucy Joseph took her hand. God is here, in the calluses on your fingers from all the work you've put in planting so that we can eat.
Did you know from the beginning that I would join? She asked.
I had an inkling on the day we met.
But you didn't say anything.
Mother Lucy Joseph pulled the brim of her gardening hat close to her forehead.
In my opinion, it's not for anyone else to tell you what's inside yourself.
She wanted to share her whole story then, to tell Mother Lucy Joseph about Patrick, about Nora. She knew that if she stayed, she would have to confess it eventually. But it had been so long since she felt such warmth. She didn't want to lose the other woman's affection. Everything she and Nora knew about each other, they learned through relatives in another world. News had to travel from one of them across an ocean and then back to the other. Their gran kept them informed in vivid detail, hoping for a reconciliation. Gran wrote to her about Patrick, Nora's beloved boy, and then about the births of another son and a daughter in turn. One day, feeding calves with Sister Placid, it struck her that she had stopped thinking of them by their given names. For so long she wanted to call her friend Kathy, had to stop herself every time. Her own name, Sister Cecilia, felt like something she was wearing and could take off at any moment. But without noticing, this had changed. She was here. She was in it. The rules softened some as she proved her dedication. The low, steady voice beneath got louder and louder as her doubts shrank down to a whisper. She knew from what the other nuns said that they might never go away completely, but it was something. Still, she did not know if she would stay for good. Some women left after years. Sister Anne had lived at the Abbey since she was 27. She walked out weeping one morning when she was 40. What life would she have now? She seemed so disappointed, and yet she knew somehow that she had to go. How? Sister Cecilia asked Mother Lucy Joseph.
In time, you just know.
When someone who had been there far longer than she had went away, all the doubts returned. Longevity was no mark of anything. Things could come apart so fast. But that's true for everyone, Mother Lucy Joseph said. Think of a marriage, husband and wife, the piece of paper, the white wedding dress. They don't promise anything. A person has to stay there, fight for it, every day. Her last hesitation when she thought about taking final vows was Patrick. She had been picturing him as a baby all this time, even as she knew he was getting older. She lit a candle in the chapel each year on his birthday, watching the flame, thinking of him as he turned 4, then 5, then 6, then 7. What did a 7-year-old boy look like? She would have to give him up once and for all if she stayed. She knew that she already had. He was only a memory now, a medal in her pocket. Still,
She thought of him and of Nora all the time. She herself might have once imagined women running off to convents to hide from some unwanted truth, but her experience proved just the opposite. To sit alone with your thoughts in silence for so long, you had no choice but to confront them. The calm came not from slipping a habit over one's head, but from facing down all that plagued you and coming out on the other side. After much prayer and with Sister Placid's encouragement, she wrote to Nora at last. Nora wrote back with news of her children. They corresponded once every few months after that. Their notes at first were cordial, formal. Nothing like their relationship had been, but they grew warmer in time. In their sixth year at the Abbey, Sister Placid took her final vows, becoming Mother Placid. Sister Cecilia still wasn't sure she would stay. She thought of Patrick more and more. She had believed she was past it, but the yearning for him returned. She dreamt of him. Finally, she told Mother Lucy Joseph what she was wrestling with. She had always feared that were it ever made known, she'd be penalized or forced to leave for keeping such a secret. But there were nuns here, widows mostly, who had grown children. Mother Lucy Joseph, in her calm way, said that if the child was safe and happy, if she had asked God's forgiveness for any wrongdoing on her own part, then she ought to feel forgiven. "I've always had this belief that I would go back for him one day," she said. "Maybe it was a fantasy to begin with, but if I stay here, that possibility dies." "Perhaps you need to see him once more to be certain," Mother Lucy Joseph said. And so she wrote to Nora. "If you ever want to visit the Abbey, you could bring your children on our annual fair day next month. I wouldn't be able to spend much time, but we could at least say hello." She put it that way, "your children," so as not to scare her sister. Nora took 2 weeks to reply. She wrote that she had never told them that she had a sister. She was sorry, but that was the truth of it. Sister Cecilia wrote back right away, "They don't have to know who I am. I just love to lay eyes on them." On him. Finally, Nora said they would come. Sister Cecilia watched the gates all morning, waiting for them to drive in. On this one day a year, the Abbey was open to the public, a fundraiser where people could see how the farm worked. But the nuns were meant to observe their usual silence. She knew she would only have a minute. When she saw them emerge from the parking lot, she walked toward them, meeting them on the dirt path that ran alongside the sheepfold. Nora wore a smart skirt suit and heels, pink lipstick, like the kind she herself had once worn. She looked entirely like a woman now, all the girlishness gone from her. The children, too, were neatly dressed, the boys in jackets and pressed pants, the girl only 2 years old, wearing a yellow party dress and Mary Jane's, a white straw hat, a pair of white socks trimmed with lace. "Good morning," Sister Cecilia said, meeting Nora's eye. Nora didn't recognize her. "Good morning, sister." Slowly, she saw the fact of it sinking in on Nora's face. She let out a laugh. "Teresa?" Nora looked like she might crumble for a moment, but then she stood erect. "This is my friend's sister Cecilia," she said. "Say hello, children."
"Hello,"
they replied in unison. It surprised her that Nora and Charlie's children spoke with a